Hello, this is Rawiyat Podcast. In each episode, one of our members sits down with a woman filmmaker from North Africa, the Middle East, or the diaspora. Together, we explore their creative journeys, the challenges they faced, and the remarkable work they've shared with the world. This conversation celebrates the voices and vision shaping the cinema of our region today. I am Dorothée Myriam Kellou, and today I welcome Asia Boundaoui, Algerian-American journalist, filmmaker, and curator. We had met in 2019 in Carthage at the GCC. She was screening her first feature film, The Feeling of Being Watched, and I was presenting mine, In Mansoura You Separated Us. We started having conversation about how to handle personal and collective traumas in films. I am glad to finally record this episode, in which we will further explore the possibilities to heal from historical traumas through creative documentary films. Asia Boundaoui, you are... I would like to open certain questions with you in this podcast, especially the question of how to make a film, a political film, that is also intimate, exposing your family's history, the traumas of community. The question also that I would like to raise, is it a form of reparation, a form of healing happening while making this film? But we will start with the beginning. Why did you decide to make this film, first of all? I understand that you realized that there were some important question to raise, including mental health issues that you observed in your community that had been put under the FBI surveillance. But when did you decide exactly to make this film? When did it become a necessity?
I think it wasn't all in one moment. I think I had questions that I never received, sufficient answers for. Questions like, why did I grow up always knowing that our community was being watched, and who was doing the watching, and why were they watching, were questions I always had, but for a long time, kind of put in the back of my head. I was doing radio for many years and then was invited to work on a documentary film as an archival researcher. And in the making, in working on this film, in a really junior position, I think it opened to me the possibility of exploring these questions in film, because I was talking about the experience of being watched, that it was necessarily should be a visual format. I think like leaving radio and starting to work on film allowed me maybe just like the language for how to ask these questions and address them in the film. But I didn't know what answers I would come across. It was a 5-year long process making the film, and I didn't know what the answers would be to these questions. And, the questions kind of remained the same and some more and more added over the years, but it was only in the making that I started to get some answers for those questions: why and who and when and how did this happen? So yeah, I don't think there was one clear aha moment, but I think I decided I'm going to start asking these questions, and that the medium to, explore these questions would be through film, because surveillance is about watching and being watched and seeing and how we're seen. That was the only way to, that was the best language to do it in. And then I think that in terms of like making a personal film, I think that's the form that it took, a personal film. It could have, I could have asked these questions and, done a different kind of film, many different kinds of films, but it was necessarily ended up being personal because, first of all, I didn't know if the process of asking these questions would ever result in any satisfactory answers. So it was important to show the process of asking, the process of digging, the process of trying to get those questions answered, that that was, you know, that that journey of asking was in fact the film, which necessitated, you know, showing and it revealing my process. And the form it took was personal because the questions, you know, one of the questions you don't ask when you start making a film is, why are you making the film? You think you're making the film just to answer these, you know, political questions, let's say. Why was this Arab and Muslim community being surveilled, you know, a decade before 9/11? What was the FBI interested in? What was the scope of the surveillance? How did it affect people's lives? You know, that is, those are ostensibly the questions you're asking, but there are also, when you start making a personal film, you are at, you know, there are deeper questions that you end up having to answer, which is like, why am I really making this film? And I think that when I asked myself that question, and that wasn't until, you know, 2 or 3 years into the making, at least 2 years into the making, it was like, oh, this is about something deeper. This is about mental health. This is about the fear of that. This is about seeing how that's affected different people in the community. You know, that there were like the causes of this pain and then the effect of it, and untangling those two was this like political and personal journey.
So yeah, you start opening questions and you dig deeper and you understand that there might be a more intimate dimension throughout childhood or adulthood. You have like realized how it has affected you and your family and your community, and you put that into words more clearly. And this is also a process I really felt while making my own film. And I had a question because for me, in my own film, in Mansoura, You Separated Us, that really excavates my family's history and the trauma of a community in Algeria during the revolution, it was also difficult to include my family in this project. And I finally didn't include my mother and my sister, although in the beginning I thought I would include them. And my father became the main character. I think your mother has a strong place in your film. And I was wondering, like, how did you manage to involve her and accept actually to be part of a process being filmed while in a way reproducing the feeling of being watched, although watched by your daughter and very differently? But it's a tricky situation. Like, how did you manage to do that?
You know, I would say from the very beginning, my mom was also curious in these questions and supported me asking them. And she was where I started, you know, oh, when did this happen? What was your experience when you received a visit from the FBI? Have other people told you their stories about it? You know, I think it was like, having accepted a certain thing from childhood, which is we're just being watched, and then finally asking my mother, like, you know, what was that about? What's really going on? As I grew up, you know, as an adult, and having her answer these questions and actually really help guide the direction of the investigation. The thing was, we also used my mom's house as like our headquarters, our production headquarters, because we were filming in that neighborhood. And all of my neighbors were main characters in the film, the community itself, which is, you know, the geography of where the surveillance happened, but also the geography of the community and the people that spoke to me and allowed this film even to happen. They were all there. And my mom, you know, was still living in that neighborhood. So every time we filmed, we would go put our stuff down, set up at my mom's house and talk to her about what we're going to do today and what we're. And so it was like, just became really organic that she was very comfortable. Like she would tell us, oh yeah, you should go film with so-and-so auntie, you know, who lives 2 blocks away. I remember her telling me this story. So we were having all of these like off-camera conversations, and then they started to become on camera. The very first, I think, like interview, which the film starts with, the very first interview did was with her too. It was very organically, the leads for our investigation would come out of these conversations we were having with my mom. And she was just like a very willing participant in sharing this information. She wasn't afraid to share it. She was, you know, we experienced a lot more hesitation as we went around, but my mom was always just from the beginning, like unafraid about sharing this. And she became comfortable with the camera just because also her house was the HQ, you know. And she was very much herself. Like I actually didn't know how much of a character she would end up being in the film until we were in the edit room. And it's like, oh, wow, we have so much, you know, footage with my mom. A lot of these conversations I'm happening that are, you know, when I find something out, when I get documents back and I realize and I go back and I have these conversations with my mom, ended up being kind of, you know, anchors throughout the film. But it was because she was just, you know, a very willing participant and very much herself on camera without realizing like how much of herself really she was being. Mm-hmm. But she was just, you know, she was just like authentic, and her role in helping guide it was very much an organic thing also.
Yeah, that's very, very telling. And it shows the importance of an ally in a documentary film process, like a reliable character. And I experienced that with my father, who in the beginning was kind of reluctant to participate, like to be filmed. Like it would be like, oh, you can film the uncle, you can film the aunt, you know. And I was like, no, but you're part of the story. You know, it's the story of a community that has been affected by forced displacement during the War of Independence. And you're part of this story. And I remember at some point when he felt dignified, showing the photos and the films I had made. I think it was important to have this kind of relationship and respect in some ways. And I think it really shows in your process that you're on a very horizontal approach, and you're not being the, you know, the caricature of a director that impose question and impose like a way of being and answering. And
I think I started out that way though, actually, too. To be fully honest, you know, I mean, I studied journalism. I came from a journalism background. And when I started making the film, it was very much like that. It took 2 years for it to become personal. But in the beginning, I was like, you know, holding a mic behind the camera, asking people I knew questions I knew the answers to. You know, it was all very like arm's length. And I think that was also maybe a protection from like it getting too personal, which it eventually did. And that was kind of the much more honest way of making the film, of approaching people that I knew that I was in community with. I think it was also a relinquishing of this idea of objectivity. It's a documentary problem too. Like the origin of documentary is an ethnography, this outsider coming to a place that they're outside of and like trying to discover. So there's not many models, I think, for what it looks like to tell a story from inside, you know, that community. And replicating this outsider like positionality was like a natural thing to do from like journalism training. And I had to like unlearn those things to realize like, oh, you can tell the truth about something being from inside of it and close to it. This idea that you need a distance from a thing. It's like a very colonial old ethnography, you know, baggage that we have in documentary and in journalism. You know, we are all subjective, and you can tell a story from closeness to it. And I think the honesty comes from transparency, from like revealing your process, you know, talking about how you did it, how you are in relation to the people you're interviewing, you know, showing that. And I think that's the most honest way to do it. But yeah, I think definitely in the beginning, it was very, it took a process of making the film to like end up making it in this way that you think, oh, you know, I can see your relationship to the people in it. Like that took a while for me.
Every time I went for the groceries, I saw the car. I went to drop off the kids, I saw the car. And we kind of thought that our house was bugged too, that somebody was looking into our house all the time.
You feel like someone's just invading your life, you know? I have a feeling that there is a camera, there is something watching, and you don't feel free, you don't feel safe.
But I was wondering in terms of emotional distance, because of course you're digging and uncovering questions that have affected you also directly, as you have memories from childhood of also feeling watched. Is there a moment like where it became too heavy emotionally? I remember a scene where you actually on the couch, lying on your mother, like shoulders and knees. And it's a beautiful scene. And I had seen like that with my father, but I wasn't able to add it to my film because I felt so vulnerable. I think it's so beautiful that you went to the step of like actually showing this vulnerability, although knowing that it may be watched also by the FBI. You know, it's like a never-ending process of being watched and watched. And so how did you find the courage in some way to show this vulnerability?
I mean, it was really having a good team, because I would have never wanted to film it, but my cinematographer, we got close enough at that point. I was mic'd, you know, so she was hearing, you know, what was happening in the other room with my mom, and then eventually like just came and like started filming it. At any point I could have stopped it, but I allowed it to go on. And then even in the edit, I didn't want to watch it. I allowed my editor to take that scene and cut it based on her, you know, sensibilities that I trusted. And she was a brilliant collaborator and someone I really trusted, our editor, Jabal Haj Yahya. And it was, you know, a testament to that relationship too. So I had to distance myself from both the filming of that moment and the inclusion of it, because obviously, you know, yes, it's very vulnerable. The instinct is not to show that vulnerability. Also, how do you balance being like a serious investigator with being an emotional person? And, you know, all of that is more fraught when you're a woman also and professionally trained as a journalist. We realized that it was important for the film. I think I had to distance myself in the edit from this character that I'm seeing on the screen and the person that is me. There had to be like some distance at a certain point. And also to say like, you know, this is a part of a story that I was in. This is not, I'm not frozen as this person forever too. But yeah, I don't, you know, it's hard. I think that a big part of it is having a team that you trust and that you can like delegate certain parts of this process to, that can handle those emotions with tenderness and care. But yeah, not easy. Definitely not easy. I understand why you wouldn't want to include something like that. But yeah, it's something people always remember from the film, which, you know, to my horror, it's something people constantly reference, you know, as I would like to have, like, you know, never see it or reference it again. Because, you know, there's like, you know, you're embarrassed of that vulnerability, but also like, you know, rarely do people see someone being vulnerable and not think, wow, that's a courageous thing. You know, we do that to other people, but it's hard in the moment to sense anything but like, oh, this is a weakness. This is me showing weakness, or it's cringy, you know, even until today, it's like cringy, but I don't regret including it. And I think it's only with having a team that I trust that it was possible to end up making it into the film.
Yeah. And also like the importance of having a team that value vulnerability and doesn't see it as a voyeurism, you know, because there is a fine line. And I think that in our stories, I think the question of subjectivity is still hard to tell, you know, like to open, where there might be more desire to hide certain feelings. I'm realizing now that it's so courageous to have like characters actually crying, but with dignity, you know, and not, you know, we don't look at them in a with pity, you know, we have empathy. Like there is a fine line, and it's not always easy to do in these intimate and political films, I think.
Yeah, I think it's also, it speaks to this, like what we as directors ask from our participants or want from our participants that we're unable, you know, that sometimes we're unable to give, you know, it's like expecting a particular vulnerability from the participants in our film. And it's so hard to do that ourselves. You know, it was so hard for me to do that myself, even being the author of the film, you know, and being able to control how I used it, how I included it in the film, the context, the score, all of it, having all of the control, and still it felt incredibly vulnerable. Imagine what it is we as filmmakers ask for our participants to trust us with when they're vulnerable on camera, talking about sometimes the most difficult, you know, moments in their lives, and have no idea how it's going to be cut into the film, how it's going to be used, with what, you know, what dignity and respect it's going to be handled. I think that it's something big that we ask as documentary filmmakers, and it's good for us to experience what it feels like being on the other end of that, even still being totally in power of how we're going to portray it and still feeling vulnerable. So it's a reminder of like the responsibility of how we deal with participants in our film when they are cracked open or when we're cracking them open, you know.
And actually, that opens another question that I had, which is related to the re-traumatizing process of making these kind of films. Because when you reopen certain questions that have been traumatic in the past, that can be very triggering. And I was wondering if you had taken this aspect into consideration and had maybe even included like a cost of a therapist, maybe for yourself as a filmmaker or for other witnesses in the film. I had not realized personally how many nightmares I would go through by just opening wounds from the past that I had not experienced myself, but because I was so close to the subject, I was haunted by it. And I think that production companies don't take into consideration the emotional, psychological cost of this intimate and political film. So I was wondering if you had actually been a pioneer in this.
I don't know. I think people have been quietly doing it for a while. But when I was making this film, it became like something I talked about openly and at the time was becoming like widely accepted that you would put therapy as a line item in your budget if you were working on a personal film, you know. And it's now become even common to do it also for your participants of your film. So, that's something that I did early on. I realized like, oh, all of the things that I unpack are not necessarily for the film. Okay, I'm asking these deeper questions and the answers matter, but the answers can inform how I make this film. They don't necessarily need to be in the film, and there needs to be a safe place for me to be unpacking all of this outside of this film, which is when I started therapy, actually, for the first time. It was like, you know, a couple of years into the making of this. And also, it's like, it is, of course, it's very hard. Like, you're going through it, you know, and it's emotionally really heavy. And you can't finish the film if you're still, you know, if you're like stuck, or if you fall down a rabbit hole of depression, or, you know, like you need a way out also, and you need a way to process it outside of the film. I would say like through the life of the production and post, you know, after the film goes out in the world too. I think that's a really important time because, you know, at least when you're in production, like it's all still between you and your participants. And it's when you're finished and it's out in the world, people are asking questions at Q&As. Like it's the first time you're really putting all of that vulnerability out there, and the way people deal with it is like no longer in your control. So I think that something that I would do differently, like, you know, I had therapy through production, but as soon as we were done with the film, I was out of therapy. And I think that was the time that I probably needed it the most, is that also there's this, you know, second effect of like when it's out in the world, and also that you start disconnecting yourself from the work and the project, which I think is like every filmmaker goes through what we call something like a postpartum period when you're done with the film for so many years or so long, you've been associating yourself, your identity with this particular project, with the story, with this work, and suddenly it's done. And so then how, you know, who are you without this story, without this film, without this project? It's difficult. I think especially for the first film, because you don't expect it. You should, you know, there's this idea that you should be happy. The film is doing well in the world. And well, you know, why aren't you happy? You know, but yeah, this postpartum thing is very, very real. And I think when you're making a personal film or film that is, you know, re-traumatizing in any way, it becomes even more important to make sure that you have support post life of the film.
So it's easy to negotiate with a U.S. producer, for example, to add a line for therapy?
Yes, it's become a common line item, yeah, for therapy.
Interesting, because I don't think it is the case in France. I don't know for the rest of Europe and the Middle East.
It's a new thing. I think that people have to fight for it too.
Yeah.
You know, that, and then like now that there are examples of people doing it, it's easier to say and justify, you know, and thinking about, you know, different models for how that works. There's a really great film documentary called Subject that is about the relationship between filmmakers and their subjects. And it's like five really, really popular documentaries. One of them is The Square, in fact, and what happened to like the main subjects of those films after the film, and like the kind of trauma that they had to deal with and how they had to deal with it on their own a lot of the time. And yeah, it's really interesting. And that film is a model also on how they made it, because all of the participants in that film are co-producers. They all got extensive therapy line items in the budget, you know, so there are models. And I think they actually like share some of these things, like their budget and all of that. They're very transparent about it. So yeah, I would recommend looking into some of the discussion that came out of that film.
Would you be able to share like how emancipatory it has been to make this film, and as a way to encourage, you know, young filmmakers, especially in the Middle East or North Africa, in the diaspora, to tackle these questions, both intimate and political, that may be very difficult to handle? I was wondering if you had like an advice, a story about this whole emancipatory process.
Do you think that making your film was emancipatory? Is that what you felt at the end of it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think for my father, it was very freeing. And he's now working on a film. His emotional block and creative block have disappeared. In the village, you know, like, there is an important witness who has become very close to me, who told me, now I can live, you know, and be tranquil, you know, because my story is told, it's not silenced anymore. And I think that it's beautiful to see that also personally, this is not an obsession for me anymore. I can move on, you know, like for many years, I was obsessed with this story. I was obsessed with telling the stories of the camp, forced displacement, and the consequences of uprooting, like, so I can move on and open new questions. So for me, it has been liberating, but the liberation has a cost.
I don't know that I would use that word liberating. Maybe I think that what the film did was it created more space. Like the space was claustrophobic and it pushed open and created more space to talk about something that we never really talked about out loud, or that was only framed by other people about us, by like, you know, in saying something out loud, you release some shame and you create some more space when you release shame. I think that that was a big part of it. You know, I wouldn't, you know, be so bold as to say, you know, it like changed people's lives, but I think it allowed us to feel some narrative justice, you know, at least that we would author this part of the story, that the decades of surveillance and this bullshit investigation that the FBI undertook is like revealed as the sham that it is, instead of like, you know, thriving in secrecy and being brought back to life by the government as a success story. At least it's shown now that this was a failure and an embarrassment of the U.S. government in undertaking this. And that also perhaps it's a warning that like, that we will find out the truth about what happens, even if it's hidden about us, even if it's made secret, that it comes to light, the truth comes to light. And, you know, there's some satisfaction, I think, in that. Does it prevent, you know, I think the surveillance is ongoing. The Muslim community, the Arab community, Palestinian community is still going through surveillance, censorship. Like, you know, I don't think that the story really has ended. But there's some satisfaction in knowing at least that we can write the story ourselves, and we can, even if we don't have control over the ending. Yeah, there's something like empowering and dignifying that we don't have to be ashamed about this thing, that the government, in fact, is the one that should be ashamed of what they did, of what they're doing, and that we will discover the truth. Cannot be hidden for too long.
Narrative justice. This is a word that I will write down, because I think it's very important when you work on silenced stories by states. And
it's actually coined by Native American. It's like an indigenous concept, this idea of narrative justice.
I think I'm going to end with this very beautiful comment. And maybe also, you know, encourage filmmakers to tell the stories, and sometimes also to not expect too much of it, because it's true that a film is not a way to solve all the political issues we face, but it's a contribution to tell from a different perspective these important stories, and that is a form of justice, narrative justice. Thank you so much, Asya.
Thank you, Dorothée.
Slama.
Slama.
I am not sure we can liberate ourselves from historical traumas, but we can certainly beautify the wounds, our wounds, inherited and present. Thank you, our listeners, filmmakers, for tuning in. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, on Facebook, Rawiyat, Sisters in Film.